From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. Ceremony and ritual are important elements in American society, from matrimony and divorce to collegiate and professional sport to the intricacies of corporate protocol and gamesmanship. But just how ceremonious are most Americans? John Sisk of Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, offers these comments on what he calls the unceremonious American.
By the unceremonious American, of course, I think your reference is to an essay I published recently, which originally was an address I delivered to an American studies group. And I was there tracing the attitude towards ceremony that is seems to me a very characteristic part of American life, mm-hmm. and that really begins with our Puritan beginnings in England, but expressed itself very early in a suspiciousness about old world ceremony and ritual, and continues to do that in interesting ways right up to our own time. Mm-hmm. It's good insofar as it is part of the American effort to be different from the old world, part of the American's business of finding himself. It's bad insofar as it gets mixed up with a negative attitude towards civilization, a negative attitude towards authority, which it does. Much of this you can see in the history of the West, and in particular in the myth and the legend of the West. Mm-hmm. Our cowboy heroes who so cater to our conviction that the he-man stands beyond ceremony, that there is something in ceremony that denies your personhood, that you must stand outside ceremony, which is a way of organizing people together, mm-hmm. if you're going to be your true self. And of course, in recent years, the human potential movement has encouraged this bias against ceremony, if you want to call it that. Mm-hmm. Again, with that emphasis on the wonder, the sacredness of the individual, and that nervousness about imprint that other people might have upon your individual sacredness. And what I'm talking about, what others have referred to as the me generation. Mm-hmm.
You just referred to the human potential movement. Mm-hmm. Would you care to comment on that?
Which is full of psychobabble. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to recall now who wrote this piece on psychobabble. The piece that I read, I think it was in the New York Times Magazine. Uh-huh. Sound like something William Safire might have written, as a matter of fact. But I thought at the time, which was my first encounter with the term, that's wonderful. That really, that's a good umbrella for the jargon that has come out of what I refer to here as the human potential movement. Mm-hmm. All those buzzwords, which are so important, actually, if you're caught up in it. Yeah. They validate the whole activity, and they make you feel good. Mm-hmm. And actually, they're simply what happens in other areas. We all have our psychobabble. Mm-hmm. Although I think that the psychobabble of the human potential movement, right at the present time, is beginning to look rather fatuous, or more so than it did earlier.
John Sisk was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. Professor Sisk teaches English at Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. The National Humanities Center recently undertook a discussion of the connections between philosophy and public policy. Speaking in the following order, the participants in the discussion are James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Alabama at Birmingham; William Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center; Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation; and George Schur, a professor of philosophy at the University of Vermont.
The influence of philosophy on public policy in the past has been much more indirect than it is now, I think. A lot of philosophers today want to have direct input into the process of formulating public policy.
You mean they want to go and testify in Washington? This sort of thing?
Sure, or write articles and books addressing specific issues of public policy. You might say that John Locke had tremendous influence on formation of public policy because Locke's philosophy was influential on the framers of the American Constitution, for example. But you didn't have Locke writing articles and books on specific issues of public policy. It was a case of a philosopher who did his philosophical work, and it had an influence. Mm-hmm. Today you have George Schur writing an article on whether or not abortions ought to be funded by the government. It's much more specific and direct.
Almost like a consultant rather than someone who's providing background. I mean, someone who's addressing a specific question.
I think philosophers are very self-conscious about providing background today. I mean, philosophers are writing with an eye to influencing public policy rather than simply addressing their philosophical questions and letting the influence come where it will.
Jim, if philosophers are writing with an eye to influencing public policy, why is it that, at least in the popular conception, philosophers are so removed from the workaday world? Or is that incorrect?
I don't think it's incorrect at all. I think philosophy suffers from a kind of peculiar twin misunderstanding. People either think philosophy is a lot more important than what it is, or a lot less important than what it is. Tell someone you're a philosopher, you get either the, oh, then you know the meaning of life kind of response, which I think takes philosophy more than what it is, or the opposite, oh, that's just trivial. That's you've got your head in the clouds and you're not connected with anything that's happening in the real world. Now that's a great problem. Philosophers, for a long time in this century, I'd say for the first 60 years of this century, many philosophers explicitly disavowed any close connection between what they did and matters of public policy. It was said that the business of philosophy is the analysis of abstract issues, period. That philosophers are not ministers or guidance counselors. It's only been within the last, 10 years, really, that philosophers have begun to think of themselves as commenting on actual concrete moral and political problems.
Is that connected, do you think, with the Vietnam War and philosophers becoming involved in that controversy and then going on to think about other moral issues, having stated positions on the war?
I think a lot of things happened at once in the 60s. The civil rights movement was very important. I think the women's movement was very important. The protest against the war in Vietnam was very important. There were a lot of boiling social issues that were on everybody's mind. In addition, moral philosophers began to rethink the relationship between their subject and concrete moral issues. At the same time, remember, philosophers of science were rethinking the relationship of their subject to the concrete business of science. I think what has happened in moral philosophy parallels in an interesting way what happened in the philosophy of science. Now, I think, philosophers realize that they need to know a lot about science in order to do philosophy of science. 20 years ago, I don't think that was true.
Wasn't there some, apart from events we might call in the external world, that Steve mentioned, war in Vietnam and others that you mentioned, wasn't there some sense of dissatisfaction within the discipline itself, either arising from people within philosophy or perhaps their neighbors in other disciplines or their students, that philosophy was growing just too abstract, too far removed Now, one could see that events in the world could sort of help stimulate this, but weren't philosophers sort of bringing the indictment upon themselves to some extent?
I think that's right. I take a pretty mundane view of this. I think there are fashions in academic areas, and any time one way of thinking has dominated an academic area, no matter what that way of thinking is, no matter what the area is, if this has gone on for half a century, people are liable to grow weary of it and look for something a little different. Mm-hmm. The idea that moral philosophy really didn't or can't contribute anything to the consideration of practical issues had dominated philosophers' thinking for a long time. I think things were ripe for a change.
Wasn't there, let me ask George, anyone, wasn't there particularly when we talk about political issues or issues of public policy, issues of ethics, wasn't there this dissatisfaction I'm talking about, wasn't there something going on in regard to the fact that it was a fairly respectable opinion, I guess, among philosophers some years ago, that there really couldn't be much of a rational analysis of these kinds of questions? We have what's I guess called emotivism, theories of emotivism that matters of morality are not really rational matters. Now that's itself a philosophical position and an interesting one, and then books were written and articles were written. But did acceptance of that make any difference? Did that lead people to avoid trying to do a rational analysis of some of these public policy questions? Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. If one thinks that ethics is really nothing more than a matter of mm-hmm. personal feeling, mm-hmm. And that that no moral position is at bottom any more reasonable than any other moral position, then there really isn't anything for philosophers to address themselves to. In fact, there isn't anything for anyone to address themselves to.
I think philosophers are still worried about the sense of whether the question of whether there is any possibility of arriving at truth about moral matters. But I think there's also a kind of provisional agreement that whatever we say about truth at bottom, at least we can agree that some positions are more reasonable, more warranted, supportable by better reasons than other positions. And as long as you have that, you can at least go forward and make progress. Mm-hmm. Foundational issues, I think, are still very much in a state of flux. Opinion about foundational issues.
What do you mean a foundation?
About the ultimate groundings, if any, of moral principles. People are still talking about that, and I don't suppose they're going to stop too quickly. But I think the view is that we can go ahead and make some progress without being certain of the foundations, as indeed people in many other disciplines have done. There's been debate over the foundations of mathematics for a long time. It hasn't stopped mathematicians.
Good. Yeah. Professor Kahn, yes.
I wonder whether we could go back for a moment and take a closer look at the history of the interest by philosophers in questions of public policy. If we had considered the topic in 1960, I think there would have been nothing to say. Because virtually no philosopher was involved in questions of public policy, at least not in philosophy journals. The earliest that I remember philosophers becoming involved is about 1969-1970.
Let me go back a step before that. I was a graduate student in the mid-1960s. I had become interested in philosophy primarily because I was interested in ethics, moral philosophy. I was taught as a graduate student that the philosophical study of morality had nothing whatever to do with practical moral issues. In the graduate classes I took, we never discussed abortion, we never discussed the morality of war, we never discussed anything that people commonly think of when they think about ethics. We did discuss what George Shearer called foundational issues a few moments ago. Is there any such thing as objective moral truth? Do moral statements do anything more than reflect one's own feelings? And so forth. In the late 60s, I was teaching at New York University. I began to notice that a few philosophers had written papers on such topics as the morality of war, civil disobedience. I knew of one philosophical article on abortion, and only one. I proposed to a publisher at that time that the publisher should put out a little paperback book collecting these articles by philosophers on these practical moral questions. At that time, you could put into one paperback volume virtually everything that had been written by philosophers on these subjects. Everything. Mm-hmm. I believe it was in 1969 or 70 when an organizational meeting was held in New York for what became the Society for Philosophy and Public Affairs.
A couple things. First, you remind me of a story. When I was in graduate school, a colleague of mine, another graduate student, dropped out, and I called him up and asked him why he dropped out, and he said he'd send me a letter, and he sent me a letter, and in the letter was this story from Kierkegaard, which I'm sure you're all familiar about, that Soren Kierkegaard, the Danish philosopher, tells about the man who goes down the street and sees a sign in the window that says clothes pressed here. So he runs home and he gathers up all his clothes and brings them in, puts them on the counter, and the clerk looks at him with a puzzled look, and the man says, "I brought my clothes." And the clerk looks up at him and says, "Oh, I'm sorry, sir, we don't press clothes, we make signs." And this was this young man's account for why he had left. He was hoping for some instruction about, I think, practical moral problems, and he was told, "That's not our business. We can tell you how to think about certain theoretical issues, but can't get into these practicalities." Well, let's talk about what's happened, what's changed. You said, Jim, sort of paraphrasing Holmes, there are fashions in the intellectual world as well as elsewhere. Now it's obviously shifted. I mean, you said, at the time you were talking, you could barely fill one book with the articles. Now you could fill libraries, it seems to me, with things that philosophers are writing about public policy and ethics. Steve Kahn here had a conference, which I attended, which was just for people who, I think, headed up centers, not just individuals, but people who headed up whole institutions directed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a discussion of the connections between philosophy and public policy. The participants in the discussion, speaking in the following order, are William Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center, Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation, and James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. Here is Mr. Bennett.
Okay, it's changed. Seems odd for people who are interested in the truth that they should keep changing their mind about whether what they're doing is pertinent or not. But okay, fair enough. Steve Kahn, has it been for the good or overall for good or ill, or what do you make of it in a sociological sense, but has philosophy contributed to the understanding of public policy and ethics in interesting ways in the last 10 years?
Let me answer you in a roundabout fashion.
Sure.
By following
it's
up
a roundabout question.
Follow up on what Jim said. The original topics that I think were of most interest, apart from perhaps the question about the war, which was on everyone's mind, many of the topics had to do with what has come to be called medical ethics. These were questions about abortion, euthanasia, medical practices of various kinds. Medical ethics is, I think, a paradigm case of philosophical involvement with ethical issues from another sphere. Philosophers serve in hospitals. They teach on medical faculties. And there are a great many projects around the country in which philosophers are playing a major role. I think that to answer the question, we need to clarify what it is that philosophers think that they can do when they enter into the medical school or the hospital. I think that there is confusion on this point. One having to do with the initial notion of what it means to be an expert in ethics and trying to assist other people in their ethical behavior. There is a misunderstanding, I think, that philosophers in this situation believe they are more ethical than the doctors they may be advising or the patients that they're dealing with. And perhaps there are some philosophers who have been responsible for the suggestion. I think it is a mistaken suggestion.
Is it the philosophers who believe they're more ethical or the people who call for them?
Well, maybe they both agree on it sometimes. Okay. I think it is a mistaken suggestion that the philosophers who come in are more ethical than the physicians whom they are advising. It seems to me that there's something else that philosophers might provide for physicians, a certain kind of perspective, perhaps, but it's not the sort of perspective that turns an otherwise non-ethical physician into an ethical one. And I think that that has to be cleared up before we proceed further, that it isn't or shouldn't be the claim of philosophers that in virtue of their study of ethics, that they are more virtuous than other people. This at least is the suggestion I would start with, and others would like to come.
Jim Rachels.
I don't think that philosophers have any right to claim any special virtue for themselves. But at the same time, if ethics is the attempt to discover the truth and not simply the expression of one's emotions, then philosophers have at least this advantage over doctors. They have the time to investigate the complexities of the medical problems, or the ethical dimensions of the medical problems which doctors face. And doctors themselves are much too busy to do this. I think this is one of the reasons that medical centers have found ethicists, I don't like that word, but that's the word that's used these days, useful. Almost every medical school now has at least one person in the humanities on its staff teaching courses in things like medical ethics to the medical students. Why can the philosophers do this better than the doctors? In some ways they can, but in some ways they can because philosophers have simply given more time to thinking about these issues than doctors have available.
All right, it's not a kind of division of character then, I think. It's more division of labor. Sort of thing. That is, that we don't have the model, or we shouldn't think of the consultation that's done or the collaboration that's done between doctors and philosophers as, well, the bad doctors who are sort of mere technologists and don't think about questions of right and wrong, and then the good guys, that the Texas Rangers commend the philosophers to set everything right. It's more a division of labor. What sorts of things does the philosopher bring? Or could we illustrate it with a specific kind of problem? Where, anybody give an example of where they've helped, a specific case or sets of cases, and how do they help? Is it an analysis of concepts, clarifying thinking about things? Where, if you're pressed here for evidence, or where has a philosopher helped us either understand or solve a problem?
I can give you an example of where there's been a specific philosophical influence. I'll leave it to you to decide whether it helped or not. Medical ethics is not my field, strictly speaking, but I did once write an article on medical ethics. It appeared in a medical journal. One of the things discussed in that article was the ethics of doctors' treatments of defective infants. It's a fairly common practice now to simply allow certain kinds of defective infants to die if the parents and the doctors agree. Something like this may happen. A baby will be born with Down syndrome, mongolism. Mm-hmm. It will be discovered later that the baby also has an intestinal obstruction, mm-hmm. so that food and water can't pass through its system. An operation will be required to remove the intestinal obstruction, or else the baby will die. Since the baby is mongoloid, the parents may refuse permission for the surgery, the doctors may go along with this, and the baby may be allowed to die. Now, in the same circumstances, this baby would not be killed. And suppose the baby were mongoloid, but it did not have the intestinal obstruction. In that case, the baby would live on, because there's no question of killing such babies. In the article that I wrote, I identified this assumption, which is an ethical assumption made by the American medical establishment, and in fact is an assumption made throughout the history of medicine, that there is an important moral difference between actively killing a baby, a person, on the one hand, and simply allowing a patient to die on the other hand. In this case, the assumption is that killing is a lot worse than merely allowing an infant to die. So these infants are allowed to die, but they would not be killed. Well, I wrote an article discussing this point. It appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine. I claimed on the basis of some arguments that in fact there is no important moral difference between killing and letting die. Mm-hmm. I thought this was a point of interest to me as a philosopher. It's kind of an abstract point. Is there a moral difference between killing and letting die? But it had an application, a concrete application in these cases regarding babies. Well, a few months after this article appeared, I met a woman who was the chief of pediatrics at a large metropolitan hospital. I had never met her before. And when she found out who I was, she remarked that after this article had appeared, she and members of her staff had read it, they had discussed it, and they had decided not to let some babies die that they might have let die prior to their having read this article. I was stunned. I was absolutely unprepared to learn that what I thought of as my philosophical exercise had this kind of influence in a hospital setting. Now, was that a good influence or a bad influence? It's an influence.
I don't know. It certainly made a difference, though.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to a discussion of philosophy and public policy with James Rachels, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, the University of Alabama at Birmingham, William Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center, Stephen Kahn, Associate Director of the Humanities Division at the Rockefeller Foundation, and George Schur, a Professor of Philosophy at the University of Vermont.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for the Center's radio program, Soundings, a conversation on the role of philosophy in public policy and a discussion of ceremony in American life. I hope you'll listen this week for Soundings.